so much for your love and the privilege of getting together to learn together how we can cooperate with you in the mission of reaching the precious souls you have died to save. Please guide us in our time together. Thank you, Jesus. Well, we're just a little group. I'd like to tailor what I share to what you would like. What would be most useful to you? So would it be okay if we go around the circle and you can tell me where you're from, what you do, and what your interest is specifically in the seminar?
My name is Peter. I live in Rocky Ford, and we go to church in Drug Park. And I'm a goat farmer. And I deal with a lot of immigrants regarding the goats. I try to tailor my growth of my animals to the immigrants for their needs. For me and for milk and that type of business. Doing that, I get a lot of questions like, why can't we come over on Saturday and pick up a goat? And why can't we do this? And what do you mean you're a what? So, just more information to help them understand and for me to understand that better.
I have Greeks, I have Muslims, I have Hindus, I have Jews, I have Mexicans, I have
Filipinos, just about any ethnic. We started out with one goat, and we did some research and God decided for us that this is where he wanted us to go, because goats just kind of kept showing up. We've got 60 does right now, and $3, and I get an average of 5 to 7 phone calls a day regarding, do I have any goats? Do I have any goat's milk? Do I have any 8 kids? And I don't do any advertising. I haven't advertised one word.
That's the way it is in the immigrant community, the refugee community. Word of mouth. Mm-hmm. Word of mouth. If you make friends with one family and they feel like you really care about them, you don't have to worry. There was an article that came out in the North American Division newsletter, Best Practices for Ministries, How to Grow Your Church Without Evangelism. It's a church in San Diego that has just started reaching out and meeting the needs of refugees and immigrants. And an Adventist pastor came from another country. He wasn't a refugee, and so he didn't have the easy immigration status. But he was able to get I'm not sure of all the details, but the church supported him for like 3 years. Financially, when he had no income, they cared for him, and he started working with his people and other people groups, and their work has grown. Now they have, I think it's 5 languages. They have purchased earphones and they have translators doing running translations for all these language groups, and it's incredible. Word of mouth among these refugee immigrant groups is all you need. You don't have to spend big evangelism funds on it, sending out can't afford the brochures and the advertisements. Don't have to spend big money on bringing in an evangelist. We talk about personal evangelism. That is the way the word grows among refugees and immigrants.
When we got into the building, we returned our $400. We only got 38 which was we supply our needs. And we didn't have fencing for the roads. We didn't have all the stuff. I got a phone call from our system. I got all this changing things and we picked out from the Zoom. So, what do you want? I go over there and I had enough fencing to do an outside perimeter almost half an acre. And then I'm at a town dump. Have their babies, they let their babies suck and go over, and if the babies cry, the mom goes to them until they have a couple of days, and then it's fine. The baby and the mom recognize the voice, recognize their voices. So I'm sitting there going, how am I going to build all these things? I have nothing for these things. There's a company, and I've dumped along the big trucks that come up, and they're handling off the babies like hell. He says, I got six truckloads at home.
Yeah.
He says, we're just not doing it. We do this every 6 months. He says, they haul explosives. They use it for $400. They haul all these explosives. And that's how they create them. They get them to the company and they recreate them for whatever they're doing. They don't need to create them. It's all brand new environment. Everything is brand new. So I said to the guy, he says, I live about 5 miles down the road. He said, we're all the stuff that I need, everything from plywood, sand, floors, pallets, put my hay on, everything. He says, we'll see you in October and November and another one. 6 months, I told him, yes, we take over the garden. And then that goes to my bedding too. I've got a bed on these boats. Guys are four trucks working in the area and I have to stop the car. And they're cutting down all the old dead boats and using their shredding. And so the guys are going to come to me and say, we're going to move out to find a place. I have 37 truckloads going to my place in 2 weeks. I have a place for you. I know where it is. And I have Hutterites right next to me while I'm living. And I mentioned to them that I needed specific bedding for the barn. Specific, like bedding that I need for the gravel. That's just the shade. Bedding I need for the barn for the kids. He says, I need some straw. But I could pull into my yard and he says, look at the barn field over here. He says, do you want some more pieces of this? I said, yeah, how much is it going to cost? And he says, well, let's put it. You know the barn field? We'll take half of whatever you want. So I made up 1,800 barley bales and that's the kind of barn bales.
God's supplying you with the material or the physical for the goats, and I believe He's going to supply you with the spiritual materials for the people who are coming.
Well,
did you have a chance to attend one of the Muslim pastors? Is that good? Good.
You already chatted.
Perfect. Well, that's wonderful. We're going to be talking more about
this.
Yes. Okay, we're going to be talking about several specific ones. That's great. Bhutanese refugees speak the Nepali language because they're originally from Nepal. They've been in Bhutan and now the Bhutanese government is beginning this feeling that they don't belong there. Yeah, I believe so, because I contacted the Evans Mission.
Yeah.
Because
that's where they have the first
one.
Oh,
it was. Well, if, I should have mentioned that, but this, that is a wonderful opportunity to learn so much. But I, at the one a year ago in San Francisco, I learned about what's really going on in Burma. For the last 60 years, it's not only an ethnic cleansing like Hitler and Berlin. His was fast and furious. This is slow and steady. But it's not only ethnic cleansing, it's language and religious cleansing. They've said on the treaties, Brahmin, you have to be of Brahmin descent, Burmese speaking, and Buddhist. Brahmin, Burmese, and Buddhist, and if you don't fit into all three of those categories, you don't belong in Burma. And they have already exterminated 200 groups. And they are working hard on the Karen, which is the largest minority. And that's from, you know, I don't have a map of Burma, but on Burma, on the east, actually, borders Thailand, of course, and one of the Karen people who live on the east. On the west, bordering India, is the Chin state. Now, I used to think Chin was all English, but Chin is the name of the state that has over 100 language groups in that state. It's interesting, the government has really conditioned them to the point that they just call them dialects, even though they're very, very different. Couldn't even really understand each other, they just Chin dialects and Chin. But actually, these are distinct languages, and I have been learning. There are Mizo. Now, just over the border into India, it's the Mizoram state of India. And Mizo is the language spoken in the Mizoram, state of Mizoram. But there are also many Mizo people in Chin State, Burma. And they look up to the Mizo people from India because they have their own government, and the Lord has used this. You know, it's interesting. It's very valuable to know the relationships of cultures politically overseas when you're working with them here. And it's very helpful to know for several reasons. Often, when they come here, whatever political group was in control over there expects to be able to continue to control that language group here. Or to kind of, and they don't always see their own, they don't even see it as control necessarily.
It's kind of like the palm of China. Their group, even though they left China, that head of that group that's the head of China is he's Singapore's representative, that's who's in charge, and that's who decided to go. And that's who they have to go to in order to get to people.
This is a very key factor in working with other language groups. My husband likes to say, and he is so good, I just love to just watch him. He goes into his language. We were invited, actually I wanted the whole family to be able to come, but due to, from here, to be here, but due to several things, one of which was the parents of one of our members who is a new Adventist. Her husband was Adventist. He married her, and her parents are from another, from an Adventist background, but they have become Christians. She's the only Adventist in the family. She's had that help, and they wanted to come and do a special meal for her. We didn't know, we've been planning this for a long time, to come and pray for this couple's marriage and their health. She has cancer. So, a week after we had planned to leave there to come, it's all day, was the date they had set for my husband to have a special prayer for this feast they were planning. Mm-hmm. And they were coming from Michigan. And it's interesting. They brought food from Michigan. They brought almost everything they needed from Michigan for this large feast to this little apartment. And we walked in, it was crowded, but it was so interesting to watch my husband. We walked in there, and he knows instantly who's important in the culture. He's the leader. And he likes to say it may be the old man in the corner with most of his teeth gone. And he might not look like the leader at all, but when he says move, they move. When he says nothing doing, nobody does. So when you're working with these cultures, your effectiveness often depends on whether how you relate to those leaders and how they feel about you. He walked in there, and it's interesting. He met the father, and there were other families there, and he got acquainted with each one. And when the actual program began, my husband asked the father to speak and the mother to speak. And in order, various relatives of various sides. And I saw him look way down the hall and say, "Uncle." And there was an older man who had stepped out, you know, but my husband made sure to ask him, do you have anything you'd like to share? And he said, no, that's okay. But by recognizing him and the fact that he was an elder and the fact that he might be someone who would be worth asking to speak, after the program, that man and several of the key people spent hours talking to my husband. Mm-hmm. We talked about God, we talked about... And so this is a very key point.
Well, even with the Muslims, when you're going to the house, they're really accepting the things. When you walk into the house, you recognize, if you've been around that culture, you recognize who you need to go to right away, because all eyes are on that person, or direct towards that person. Because if you go and say, talk to young fellow in the conversation for them, that conversation ends there when you get along with something. But if you will talk to the person in charge of that conversation, and it may not necessarily be the oldest person, it's whoever's at the highest rank, and that's the easiest rank. You go and talk to that person first.
Mm-hmm.
And you can go to
that's exactly
that's
true.
Great. That person.
Mm-hmm.
And when my father-in-law was a cult leader, he's an ex-Catholic. He would go, if he went into a new area, he would go and talk to the Catholic bishop and get a letter from him saying, "You go to..." And then he would outsell everybody else. Because he went, he knew the hierarchy of the Catholic Church. He knew, if I just go there and start knocking on doors, I'm not going to get anything. And when the Muslims come onto the property or whoever it is, I watch and I look and see who's the one that's decided on the roof. Who's the one who's decided whether it's going to be a young woman or whether it's going to be a young woman or an older woman. And I'll go right to through the crowd, and I'll deal with that person specifically. Next time that person will not be there, but the rest of them will come to me and say, okay, what do you do? I've taken the middleman out and I'm straightforward with the person.
Mm-hmm.
It's
in charge.
And you have to do that with 90% of the other culture. You have to do that.
Mm-hmm. That's the best way. And often we're not effective in reaching some cultures because we just go in and talk to whoever we happen to meet or make friends. Which I don't want to downplay that because God can use.
Mm-hmm. Someone that's disgruntled in one of these groups, and you take your hand on him, you can change a large part of the group because he's disgruntled, there's others disgruntled.
Mm-hmm.
And they'll change a large part of it. So you may not hold on to the majority.
Okay, go ahead and
I am somebody with you. I work at a school. We don't have a lot of active concerns with that. That has been said that Silver Lake is one of the most, as far as active groups.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're very much quite, our love of kids in the room is one of the captions on the world and rich town. But I mentioned so, but I guess why I'm more fascinated now is they is church or the elder or the minister board director. She has a practical relationship to us to go to the
community.
So I'm preparing my mind. My heart has gone to that with it.
That's wonderful. Our former Adventist Muslim Relations Director for North America, you know, Brian. He accepted the call to go to Indonesia. And a very spiritual family. They were missionaries. I'm sure if you go to Indonesia, you probably will meet them.
Mm-hmm.
They were missionaries in Cambodia.
Mm-hmm.
And then they came back to the States and had a tragic car accident.
Mm-hmm.
Two of the children, I don't know if they were twins. Two of the children killed. I believe they've adopted them but very precious family. Very deeply spiritual. If you get you must try to meet Brian a lot if you in Indonesia now I
know.
I'm not sure where they're originally from, actually. Could be Wisconsin. I'm not sure. No, I'm not sure. Well, thank you. Welcome.
I've just been working as a new Bible worker in the energy area. And I'm just interested to know, some practical ways that have worked in reaching out to people.
We're just kind of going around, since it's a small group, kind of introducing who you are, where you're from, and what you're interested in this something. Differences between Canada and I found out there's a multicultural center in Saskatchewan. Some of you attended the seminar in the last
session.
Each one of us. Well, that would be an excellent place to start. The multicultural setting to find out what language groups you have. And then, once you know what language groups you have, then you can contact me for resources. Because we, and if I don't have them, I will try to put you in touch with people who do. Now, it would be good to ask, since I'm not familiar with these centers, it would be good to ask what services they provide. What, maybe you know already.
I know with my father-in-law was dealing with European children. They provide services for the passport, green cards, jobs, some other location, getting a funding, that type of thing. Whatever the government has for them, that's what they provide. They have lately
utilize volunteers?
They're actually paid volunteers. But the problem is, my father-in-law, the reason he got involved was because one German company that he was helping out, the person who was originally working with them was charging them for everything. They drove them somewhere, they were charging them. And that's what the government wanted them to do, was to charge them. But they were charging the deserving fees. So my father-in-law got involved, and from that time, I think he's got several, 35 or 40 different families in Europe.
You know, this would be an excellent way for our members to get involved by volunteering for a multicultural center. Evidently, the multicultural center is somehow related to.
It's mostly dealt with the federal convention.
Okay, that would be good. There are also other agencies that welcome refugees, and that I don't know if it's the same as in the States. They also get government funding, like Catholic Social Services, the Mennonites.
Mm-hmm.
These are. Pablo told me those are the two main ones.
And I'm surprised we don't have the Adventist Church of Mission. We don't have a presence. I'm very surprised
we don't have a
presence. There are all the other faces.
by God's grace that could change through you. And I have a friend who does an ESL Sabbath School class. She and I taught English together in the refugee camps. And she's now working, she's producer for Hope Channel, the live Let's Pray program every Monday, Thursday evening. She's the producer of that program. She attends a Chinese church, and she met a woman who was not an Adventist. She knew this country, not very fluent English, and so she offered, would you like me to teach a class on, you know, during Sabbath school, what it means in English? And she said, yes. And she's baptized now. So, and my friend has developed a little curriculum that she uses. The North American Division Literacy Program at Hope for Humanity, Sandra Brown, is right now attending classes at the university to prepare to set up a division-wide ESL program as a part of the literacy program of Hope for Humanity for North American Division, and we're going to be partnering on that. So, there will be resources available.
Okay, but I'm just saying, you need to find out, right? So, she gave
Yeah.
So,
okay, I think.
you can go in there and say, okay, people are coming and they're saying, and they always ask them about religion.
Yeah.
What religion are you? And you say, okay, these are the contacts for this area, our Seventh Day Adventists. Mm-hmm. They come in.
Right. If it's run by volunteers, there's no.
There is
Karen. This is the largest language group in Burma, Myanmar. And they are, many of them are Adventists because of the work of Eric B. Hare, Dr. Rabbit, way back in the 1900s. And so there are many Adventist Karen refugees. And this morning I said among the worst places for refugees, I was talking about the Karen people. And I just found out there are Karen people in Calgary.
We have two families. One has no family. One has no family.
Several schools in, especially the New York Conference, they have set up a school for Karen people. But in quite a few of their other schools, they're welcoming the students in, and it's a financial challenge. But we do have some funding at the North American Vision now as a result of the Richard Sabbath offering, fourth quarter of last year. So one of the best things you can do for Karen families is to help their children to have an Adventist education. Mm-hmm. And if once you get the children in your school, the parents take a child by the hand and the other parent by the heart. And these people in the refugee camp, two reasons we have so many Karen Adventists are, number one, because of the faithful work of the beloved community. Dr. Rabbit, who is from Australia, right? And who spent New Zealand, thank you. And he went in, I was telling someone at lunch, he went into, as a missionary, he was praying about where to go, and God led him to Myanmar. And they sent him to work with the Karen people. And as he started learning the language and culture, he discovered that every culture has stories. This culture has stories about animals interacting, and the rabbit was always the wise animal. Mm-hmm. And as he learned that, it clicked. His last name was Hare, meaning rabbit. And so he capitalized on that, and he had a little, people would come to him with their hurts, and he put band-aids on it, you know. He got some medications, and started a little clinic. And so he started putting a picture of a rabbit on, he told them the meaning of his last name, started putting a picture of a rabbit on the labels for the medication, and people started flocking. Isn't God good? God sent him to that area for a purpose. God knows all of these little cultural things. And when we pray that God will lead us, He will put us in connection with people that something unique about us and unique about them, God will fit it together to win souls. And so the first key is to pray for the divine presence. Even if you're in a town where you don't hardly have any, I was working in Sacramento among refugees, and Hmong refugees do cross-stitch. And it was a family that had poor relatives overseas that had done cross-stitch and embroidery, Hmong, beautiful applique, and these huge quilts, story quilts. Oh, it's gorgeous. Relatives overseas had done this needlework and sent it for their relatives here to sell, and they couldn't seem to sell it, and they asked if I could, and I thought, I'm no salesperson. I was a call porter for a while, and I loved talking to people, but I didn't sell much. But, I mean, I can sell books about God, but anything else, I give it to me to sell, it won't sell. But they just, please, can you help us? So finally, I said, okay. At least I know English. I can call up a consignment store somewhere, probably. I called every consignment store in Sacramento, and that's the capital city of California. I could not find one single consignment store that would take their needlework. So I started calling suburbs, and finally, an hour up the highway, up the hill, in a little town of Colfax, a little gold mining town, all white Americans, you know. Here's a little consignment store that was willing to take it. So I drove up there, an hour up there, went in to see Debbie, the owner, and the only person in the store was an Asian girl sitting at the desk, and I looked at, she had a little stationery box, it just looked almost exactly like one that Japanese people had given me. We were attending a Japanese church and finding a Lao church there. And I thought, she must be Japanese. So I thought, morning is Ohayo gozaimasu, this afternoon is Konnichiwa. It's afternoon. It's morning. Okay. So, you know, all this is going through my mind. I walked to her and did a little bit. Ohayo gozaimasu. So we were instant friends. And she ended up coming. I took her to the Japanese church for the Mochi New Year, Mochi Kami, you know, they pound the sticky rice. I took her to visit the Japanese church once, and she was with us, and we were doing a Lao church plan in the afternoon, so there was nobody to take her home. We arranged ahead that she'd have to stay with us the whole day if she came. Once she started coming, you know, she went to the Japanese church once, but she loved coming to our Lao church plant. She was Japanese, but she liked coming and watching us minister to this other language. And she would come And on the drives back, sometimes we'd stop by the little school we were starting for the refugees, and we'd sit, and Alicia said, no. She wasn't sure how, if her parents could accept her becoming a Christian. I hadn't told her to be a Christian. I just invited her to the church, but she started asking questions, and then she wanted to move where she could study English more, and so I called our Japanese pastor down in London. She wanted to go to Los Angeles, so I called our pastor of the Japanese church down in Los Angeles and said, told her about her. And so she could stay with us and she could go to ESL school. So she moved out of them. She became, and she would always, every holiday, she'd send me these beautiful homemade cards that she had made, just gorgeous cards. And she ended up being baptized, marrying an Adventist from Japan, and they went back to the country. And she's now happily married to an Adventist over there. But you may live in a little tiny town with, you think there are no, it's all white Canadians or white Americans, and there might be one soul that you can connect with. And as we pray, God can put us in touch with these souls. That, and the best thing to do is, I was sharing last meeting, in Western cultures, we are taught not to visit unless you're writing. But in Asian cultures, the opposite is true. If you care, you will visit. As a pastor's wife, I get to overhear what they're teaching the pastors. And they're telling me in postmodern culture, people need their own space. They need to be able to attend church and not have too many questions asked. Don't get too personal. That's the opposite of what these people need. If you care about them, you ask questions. Some common greetings in Thailand. Where are you going? Mm-hmm. When you walk, you pass in the street, if someone says, where are you going? You might wonder, why are they asking? Are they a stalker? Are they going to... But not that, if they're asking, where are you going, maybe they can give you a ride. Or maybe, you know, another common greeting is, have you eaten yet? And if you meet at the market, what are you buying? And of course, they're always buying either rice or with rice. They're always buying with rice. Either it's rice or with rice. but they ask questions like that. Have you eaten yet? Why do they ask? Because if you haven't, they are going to fix something for you. Chances are they won't even ask. And this is something that the Thai people have an idiom they say, okay, bak bat is giving an offering to the Buddhist monks as they pass by it in the early morning. So when you're going out to bak bat to give an offering to the monks, don't ask the monks if they're hungry. Monks don't eat afternoon. And when they go out, they go barefooted, they don't know how cold it is. And after 12 noon, they don't eat a thing until 1 p.m. They eat one meal a day. And so the idiom says, when you're going to give an offering to the monks, don't ask them. Of course they're hungry. Give it to them. And in Asian culture, if someone comes to visit, you fix food. You don't ask them, have you eaten? I mean, they might... The context of have you eaten yet is if you're passing on the street, you know, just really casual. But if they come to your house, you fix a meal. Well, I don't care if it's midnight, you fix a meal. And because Hmong people pride themselves in nobody can walk through their village without food to eat and place to stay. And what's that? My friend Karen's husband is Lao, and Yeah, did she cook or did you cook that night? He cooked, yeah. My husband's the lightning cook now. So we have guests. He's places up in the water. But it's interesting. One of the very most difficult things for the Karen people, and there are Karen in Calgary too, as well as Edmonton. This is the largest, refugees from Myanmar or Burma are the largest group of refugees coming into North America right now. And the second largest is Bhutanese, and I just found out today that there is a group in Lethbridge, and third largest is Iraqi, it's from Iraq. But that was first place for the last 3 years until now, down. Third is refugees from Burma and Bhutan, who are Nepali speaking. It's interesting, the largest refugee language group is Nepali, because refugees from Myanmar or Burma speak a number of languages. The main language is Karen, but there are other languages like Zomi, Mizo, Falam, Hakka. There are over 100 language groups in the Tin State. So, but what I wanted to tell you is that for Karen people, there's an article coming out in Adventist World soon by our church planter consultant for the Karen language group. He has just been here a few years, and within 2 years he had planted 3 churches in the Carolinas among his people. And he now oversees 34 Karen congregations in the States. I want to send him up here to your group, because, but I wanted to tell you that the best thing you can do to welcome the Karen is be involved. Is get up close and personal. When they come to church, be very shy. You know, when Elder Don Corcoran, as president, and then the Wisconsin Conference, called my husband and me from California to Wisconsin, and we partnered with Minnesota so we could plant churches in those 2 states. But I'll never forget the first Sabbath we walked into the church in Minnesota where we were going to do our church plant. We were going to be 2 weeks in place, planting 2 churches simultaneously. How do you do that? God's biddings or enablings. We walked into the church, and we were there to plant churches among the Hmong. But we believe God had an additional reason. We walked into the church, and never forget it, on the left, there's a woman nursing her baby, breastfeeding very modestly. And I was so focused on getting my children to their Sabbath school classes and everything, I didn't notice till they were in. My husband said, these people speak Thai, I said, what? Because I had just kind of assumed maybe she was Hispanic or something. I mean, look. But she was Korean, and having been a refugee in Thailand, she could speak some Thai. And we were so thrilled. And we happened to be staying with an elder who had been there for years and years at that church. A deacon. He had been an elder, he was a deacon at the time. And we went, when we got home to his house, and we said, wow, you didn't tell us you had refugees from Burma coming to your church. And he looked at us kind of funny and said, we could tell he didn't have an inkling of who in the world these people were, but they had told us they'd been coming for a couple months. And we described, well, they're Asian, so they're from Burma, and he's older, and oh yeah, you know, there are a couple of families, they always leave during the closing song. If we ever get a chance to invite them to potluck, they never come. So we explained that it's probably because they don't speak English very well and very shy about the fact that they don't speak English. So they just, in these cultures, they hate confrontation. they would rather disappear completely than to cause any burden, any trouble to anyone. And so we explained that even if they know what the word potluck means, which they probably don't, they would have no idea what to bring or if anything they could make would be acceptable. Mm-hmm. And so, but we suggested one thing that we could probably do is to give them use your fellowship hall during Sabbath school time or a Sabbath school in their language. Well, they were happy to do that, you know, there was no problem. In 2 years it grew to 80 people. Mm-hmm. Now it is over 200, around 200 people. It is our largest refugee congregation in the division. And they, in fact, they outgrew the church in their meeting in the school. And so just a little bit of encouragement that the hardest thing for this language group to understand when they come to America is that people don't ask them, they don't ask them any questions, they don't listen, they don't, I mean, and they're very, very gentle about the way, they're not a type of people to complain. But in there, if we were to go to their villages, they would roll out the red carpet. I mean, they would, as soon as we walked in, they would welcome us and say, where are you from? How long have you been? Tell me about your family. How many children do you have? Are your parents still alive? And what types of food do you like? And they would fix their best food for us. When I was working in a refugee camp among the various language groups, the Hmong refugees, there was a family who consistently brought us rice. And I thought, oh, it's because the United Nations distributes it and they have an they give us what they don't use. No, that's not the case. They were getting up early in the morning before light, going out to the Thai market and buying the little money they could scrape together. They would buy vegetables, come and sit in a hut, make a little bamboo table, sit in the hot sun all day. First they would bring in and separate them, into little clumps. Then they would sit at the little bamboo table in the hot sun all day to sell just a little bunch at a time, and refugees didn't have enough money to buy, but so that they could supply us with rice. These people care so much. And then when they come to America, and they find their own church, their own brothers and sisters in Christ, and they go to church, and people say, oh, hi, happy Sabbath, and go on in. Oh, hi, nice to have you. They wonder what they did wrong. Maybe I didn't, am I not necessarily dressed right? And so, pretty soon, they'll just be sitting in the back corners. And but if you take an interest in them, find out, where do you live? Can I come visit you? Ask about their family. Ask how long they've been here. Where did they come from? What's it like in your country? And if there's a language barrier, but there's someone that can speak some. And find out that person. Yes.
An experience. That was the first time we were doing that, but we're not waiting. Mm-hmm.
But first of all, I never met nobody who was going to give me anything, no interference, just because somebody told me.
This is such a wonderful opportunity in Asian cultures. You don't have to wait to be invited. If you see on the news that there's a funeral, or especially if you have contacts at work or something, if you find out about a funeral or a wedding and you show up, they would be so honored. They would be so privileged. I think so, but we can check if you. Is that true? Is there an Indian? I think most likely they are, but it wouldn't hurt to. The best thing is if. That could be. It would be good to, it's good to ask, say I would like,
East Indians, some of them immigrated from Africa, from India.
That's a good question. I will see what I can find out.